patrol and could pick up their launch and flag it as suspicious. He also needed to plan the launch for a time when Callisto had Jupiter between it, the sun, and the other three Galilean moons. Alex ran the orbital simulation forward again. A solution existed. There was a window where Callisto was alone on the anti-sunward side of Jupiter, caught in its shadow long enough to get the storm off the ground. It made for a tight window, maybe too tight. They did have a few advantages. The storm's skin returned an extremely low radar profile compared to other ships. Her internal heat sinks could store days of waste heat, and when necessary, capillary-like microtubules in the ship's skin could be flushed with liquid hydrogen to ensure that the hull's outer temperature remained only a few degrees warmer than space. It was a very stealthy ship when it was flying dark. If the Laconians were looking for a standard rockhopper or salvaged military ship, the Storm could look too small to fit the profile. He checked the hydrogen supply, adjusted the temperature variables in his search, and looked again. The window opened a crack wider. They could take off from Callisto when the moon was behind Jupiter, then do one very hard burn with the planet blocking line of sight to the Tempest and any other inner planet observation posts. It wouldn't keep other ships and minor posts from picking up the drive plume. There were just too many eyes in the system to evade all of them, no matter how complex his flight path. But between running cold and keeping the main observers blocked, he could get a decent Delta-V for a few hours. Then they could kill the burn and float dark for as long as the heat sinks held up. Once they'd put a little distance between themselves and the Jovian system, cozied up to the gravitational low-energy paths that the belters and salvage miners used, they could fade in their fake transponder, start a very gentle burn toward the ring, and hope they looked like just one of dozens of ships headed that way. Once they were far enough away, put in a call to Saba and see if any of the Union ships had room to scoop them up and get them the hell out of Sol System. It was pretty damn thin, as escape plans went, but they were living in thin times. Alex ran the simulation back and forth, adding in various launch and escape burn projections until he'd come up with a plan that the computer agreed gave them the best chance of success, if he hadn't overlooked anything, if the variables were weighted correctly, if the gods didn't just hate them that day. He leaned back, and his skull throbbed like his brain had an appointment elsewhere. He stretched his neck. The muscles felt like he'd been punched. There had been a time he could go for hours fine-tuning a flight plan, and he still could, but the price was higher. He swatted the desk to shut down the holographic map display. The room lights came up on the small and dingy working space he was occupying during their stay on Callisto. A desk that fed directly to the storm system so that none of his queries would leak out to Callisto's larger data environment. A wall screen with access to a couple thousand different information and entertainment streams. A combination sink, toilet, and shower alcove in the corner that included a rank, mildew smell free of charge. It even had a cot with a flat pillow and threadbare blanket if he decided not to head back to his coffin hotel. All the discomforts of a naval base bachelor pad. It didn't make him nostalgic. He was stirring a chalky analgesic powder into a glass of water, the grains of medicine swirling like stars, when his terminal began playing the first few bars of his favorite Dust Runners song. "Accept connection," he yelled at it, then gulped down his medicine. The bitterness crawled up his tongue like a living thing, and he shuddered. "Yo, Bobby, what's up?" "Meet me at the dining room in 20, she said, then closed the connection before he could ask a question. Dining room was just a code phrase for a small storage compartment off a seldom-used side tunnel. It was one of half a dozen rooms they'd designated for secret meetings. They were swept every couple of days for listening devices, and members of Bobby's strike team, dressed in civilian clothes, kept an eye on them to see if anyone else was going in or out. Alex's time in the military had all been on board ships or on naval bases waiting for a shipboard assignment. He'd never been a spy or special forces operator like Bobby. He found the built-in paranoia that came with a secret mission lifestyle exhausting. "I should probably pick up some food," he said to his terminal. It beeped a recognition at him, then sent an order to a noodle shop in the lower Medina. The owner of the shop was a resistance member who would send a pickup notification to Casper. It was another code. He wasn't even vaguely hungry, but if someone heard him or got a copy of the signal, it sounded innocuous. Nothing about his life was what it looked like anymore. 10 minutes later, Alex walked into the back room of the noodle shop and found Casper waiting for him. When they weren't using the space for secret meetings, it was the noodle shop's dry goods pantry, and boxes of supplies were stacked up against most walls. The station's heating ducts had been closed off, so the room stayed about 10 degrees cooler than the shop itself, and Alex could just see his breath in the air. "How long do you need?" the kid asked without preamble.
"Dunno. Give me 2 hours, then we'll meet up at the casino. Blackjack. I'll be at the $5 table."
"Copy that," Casper said. He pulled off the heavy hooded jacket he was wearing and handed it to Alex. Alex put the jacket on and passed his terminal to Casper. The kid would wander the station for a couple of hours. Anyone who was tracking Alex by terminal location would be sent on a merry chase. It was unlikely that anyone was tracking any of them. The terminals were as stripped down and anonymized as it was possible to make them. If their false identities had been cracked, they would probably already have been picked up by security and interrogated by Laconian operatives. But Bobby had laid down the operational security law, and they all followed her rules to the letter. Casper took the terminal and stuffed it into his jumpsuit pocket, then gave Alex a cheery little wave and headed for the door.
"Wait," Alex said.
"Everything okay?" Something in Alex's tone had put a little worry line between the younger man's eyes.
"Nothing is okay," Alex wanted to reply, but didn't. "Just be careful. Something happens to you, it doubles my workload."
He tried to make it a joke, but it fell flat. The line between Casper's eyes deepened.
"I don't need you to daddy me, Alex. I know my job."
"Yeah, sorry about that,"
Alex said, then leaned against the wall and rubbed his eyes. His headache made him want to press his face against it. Only a thin layer of composites and insulation separated him from the natural tunnel. Maybe some ice that was as old as the solar system itself would be cool enough to numb the throb in his temples.
"It's no big deal," Casper said. "But my father pulled up stakes when I was 7. I didn't need one then, and I don't now."
"Fair enough. Truth is..."
Casper waited. Alex heaved a sigh.
"Truth is, I'm worried shitless about my own kid, and I'm just projecting onto you. Don't take it as anything else, okay?"
Alex waited for Casper to leave, but he didn't. Instead, he sat down on a stack of boxes labeled soy noodles and crossed his arms.
"You think the Laconians know it was us?"
"What?"
"No, I didn't mean..."
"Don't fuck around, Alex. I have family, too."
"It's not that," Alex said.
He spotted a small bag of dehydrated onion flakes and picked it up. It felt cold in his hand and heavenly when he pressed it to his temple. Casper sat on his boxes, staring and bouncing one knee impatiently.
"Then what is it?"
"He's getting serious," Alex said. "Maybe even married. Probably married. It's just making me think about how much I don't want to mess things up for him. You always think you're going to leave things better for your kid than you found them for yourself. That's not working out for me."
Alex moved his bag of onions to the other side of his head, but it had started to warm up.
"Worrying feels like you're at least doing something," Casper said.
"I get it." When I started flying for the Union, I worried about my mom so that I wouldn't feel guilty for leaving her behind.
You're too smart for your age, Alex said. But yeah, that's probably it, or close enough. I was a shit father long before I left my family to play revolutionary.
I don't know, Casper said, then stood up. My father took off because my mother asked him to stop spending the rent money on pixie dust. You'd win Father of the Year if it was down to a two-man race.
Thanks, Alex said, and surprised himself by laughing. That's a hell of a compliment.
Alex's terminal buzzed in Casper's pocket. The kid pulled it out, then said, Cap wants to know where the fuck you are.
On my way.
The dining room was an abandoned storage space about 6 meters square with spray foam insulation walls and a carbon fiber door that didn't even have a latch. Piping that entered through the walls and then just ended hinted at a past as a machine room, though what infrastructure used to occupy the space was lost to history. A tiny green chalk X had been placed on the lower left-hand corner of the door and was surrounded by other graffiti. The graffiti was mostly gang boasts and assertions of sexual prowess. The green X meant the room had been swept for surveillance less than 30 hours ago and found to be clean. If it had been red, the underground would have left the devices in place and abandoned the room. Bobby was waiting for him when he arrived. Impatience in the former Marine eluded most people. She didn't pace. She never bounced a knee or a foot. The only time he'd ever heard her crack her knuckles was before they sparred in the gym. But Alex knew something was up the moment he walked into the room. She was standing perfectly still, but she was stiff, as though she was half flexing every muscle in her body.
You're late, she said. I got caught up talking to Casper at the drop.
And now you're kind of scaring me.
We have the battleship that shrugged off the combined fleets of Earth, Mars, and the Transport Union cruising towards us because we killed a high-ranking Laconian officer. If you weren't already scared, you're fucking stupid.
And I know you're not fucking stupid, Alex, Bobby said.
Copy that, Gunny. It's a fair point, Alex said, and raised his hands in mock surrender. The dining room was his least favorite place to meet, mostly because there was nothing in it to sit on. Instead, he found a patch of wall without any pipe sticking out of it and leaned into the foam of the insulation.
Why don't you get me up to speed?
Sorry, Bobby said. She clenched her hands into fists and jammed them into her pockets. I'm pissed at you right now, and it's not your fault.
What can I stop not doing so it ain't not my fault anymore?
Bobby chuckled at that and shot him a thin smile. It wasn't a very funny joke, but he knew she appreciated his not taking her anger personally. Something's been bothering me. You're right. And Naomi's right, she said. The timer's running out on our little resistance. And what have we accomplished? We annoyed the Empire, snatched a few ships, some supplies, killed a few Laconians. And maybe I used to think it was enough to spit in my enemy's eye while he strangles me. But I've been thinking about Jillian's assessment of the objective value of moral victories, and she wasn't wrong either. Bobby went silent, like she was listening to the words she'd said. She probably hadn't spoken these thoughts out loud until just now.
Are we talking about what I think we're talking about?
I don't know what you think we're talking about, Alex.
Because, Alex said, if we're talking about packing it in, it's a lot easier to get off Callisto if we're not trying to take the storm with us. I mean, I've got a plan either way, but...
No, Bobby said. We're not talking about that. Anger roughened her voice. He wanted to pull back from her. Retreat. But he'd known her long enough to see it was the wrong way with her. Whatever she was thinking through, she needed someone to slam it up against. Placating her wasn't going to make either of them happy. Or safe. Even if she did scare him a little, she was still Bobby Draper, his old friend and compatriot. But she was also a creature of violence, whose frustrations were coming out sideways.
Copy that, Gunny,
Alex said, trying not to sound like a hostage negotiator. I'm not giving up, Bobby said. I'm figuring out how to win. How can we take our present circumstance and find the orthogonal move, the surprise attack that snatches victory from defeat? How do we do more than just survive?
Survive is a pretty good start, Alex said. I've worked up a launch plan to get the storm off of Callisto, if that helps.
Yeah, it does. But running away isn't going to solve our larger problem.
Cap, Bobby, Alex said, there are 3 Magnetar-class ships in the universe, and the one that kicked the whole combined fleet's ass is steaming toward us right now. Picking a fight with her is like me picking a fight with you. Not being scared is fucking stupid, to use your own words.
Bobby didn't answer. She pulled a terminal out of her pocket. It was one of the cheap ones that kiosks in the markets would spit out for a few bucks. Enough battery charge for a few hours, and then you just threw it away and bought another one. She tossed it to him. On the screen was a picture of a small metal ball with text printed on it, and some sort of cable running out of the top.
The fuck is this? Alex said.
The reports linked. Alex flicked the screen with his index finger, and it changed to an article about the theoretical uses of antimatter for high-energy reactors. Even so, it took him a minute to understand what she meant.
No, he said.
Oh, yes, Bobby replied. Rennie is 99% sure. She's been looking them over and doing the research. We've been able to produce trace amounts of antimatter since the Dark Ages, but it's never been practical. Now it is. The Laconians know how to produce and store it. I will bet you a week's wages that it's coming from the same construction platforms that made the Storm and the Tempest, and it's part of the resupply for the battleship. That big cannon of theirs must burn it like crazy when it fires.
Laconia is a hard target, but if you're right and we could figure a way to knock out those platforms...
Yeah, taking out their resupply is great, Bobby said. But that's just a tactical victory. That's my kind of target. It's not yours or Naomi's.
My kind of target?
If we blew out the Laconian construction platforms, Duarte and his admirals would know why it mattered. But Kit's friends at university? They're the ones we need to inspire. For them, it has to be something they can see. We have to do something that shows Laconia's not invincible, that there's a chance for us to get a new generation on board.
You want to drop these on Laconia?
Alex asked, aghast. Sure, they were enemies, but the idea of killing a planet full of people was horrifying. Even in war, there were lines no one should cross. If we start carpet-bombing civilians, we're worse than the enemy. Alex felt a rush of relief. He was still fighting for the good guys.
Okay, good. I didn't think you'd...
I want to kill the Tempest, she said. We show Earth and Mars and everyone in the Belt and every other colony out past the gates that Laconia's battleship isn't invincible. Show them that we can win. We'll create a whole new generation of people willing to fight by lighting the biggest goddamn signal fire the human race has ever seen.
Bobby,
Alex said. Something in her eyes was more frightening than her fists had been. A fervor he wasn't used to seeing there. All the fear and desperation suddenly transformed into something verging on fanaticism.
This is crazy.
We're fucked, and we've been playing not to lose. I'm going to start playing to win.
No, you're not.
Bobby stared at him. Her jaw slid forward a fraction of a centimeter. Every fiber of his body told him to back off, except for the one little part of his brain that knew showing weakness now was a path to disaster.
You aren't, he said. You're stung because we had a win in our hands and we lost it. And then Jillian twisted the knife because she was frustrated too, and she's kind of an asshole. And we found this.
He held up the hand terminal with the antimatter information.
So it feels like the universe handed you a way to redeem the loss. But what you're really doing is trying to win back what you've lost by going all in.
It's shitty poker, and even worse is a battle strategy. Fuck you, Alex, I do this for a living.
And you're really good at it, and you're smart, and I'm just a glorified bus driver who takes you where you need to be so you can kill people.
But you're wrong about this one, and you know you're wrong.
That's not what I meant.
You want the big, symbolic victory, Alex said. When has that ever been the smart move?
For the first time, a shadow of doubt crossed Bobby's eyes. She crossed her arms, but she looked away from him. He leaned forward.
You're frustrated, and you feel trapped. And hitting back hard is what you do when you feel frustrated and trapped. But let me get us out of here. We'll get these little balls of hell to Saba. And yeah, maybe he'll send us back and we can take the Tempest down. Or maybe he'll do something else. But let's get more voices weighing in on this plan before we go all damn the torpedoes, okay?
You think it's an unwinnable fight? That's what you just said.
I do, Alex admitted. But I've been divorced twice now. I wouldn't take my word as gospel. I could be wrong about a lot of things. Yeah, your best soldiers are old shoe leather like you and me, but kids like Casper are here too. Not as many as I want, not as many as I think we're going to need, but some. I just don't think we should throw them away without a lot of consideration. Let's get out of Sol System. Let the big brains have a crack at the new info and see what they think is the right strategy.
Bobby took in a long, slow breath and let it out through her teeth. How long before dust off, if we run?
We've got some time.
All right, she said. I'll think about it.
Good,
he said, and stood up, ready to give her the room. Alex.
Yeah, Gunny?
Don't take this wrong.
All right.
If you really believe we can't win, you should think about whether you're coming with me if I go. Chapter 18. Naomi. It wasn't the first time Naomi had found herself the new addition to a crew. Even under the best circumstances, there was an unsettled period. Anyone coming into the webwork of established relationships, enmities, and personal loyalties that was a ship's crew needed time to find or create their own place. A time of isolation in the midst of a crowd. In that sense, her appearance on the Bikaji Kama was no different from other times. In the sense that she had appeared on the ship halfway through a run without stopping at a station or transferring over from another ship, it was a little weirder. And while they'd kept her identity hidden from Laconia, the small town's worth of crew on the ship was corrosive to secrets. Even as the command staff made a point of not noticing her existence, everyone knew who she was. Her presence was equal parts embarrassment to the transport union, threat to the crew, and the most interesting thing that had happened in the long weeks of transit. Pulling herself down the corridors or getting meals from the commissary, she felt the attention in the way people didn't meet her eyes and the killing effect she had on conversations. When they reached Oberon, she would need to vanish for a while and hope that her mysterious appearance was put down to rumor and myth. I was serving on a ship last year, and when the ship was searched, Naomi Nagata just showed up in with the crew. Stayed with us for the rest of the run. It was implausible enough that it might pass. Or it might be a problem. Either way, she had to touch base with Saba and see what her options were. The advantage of keeping the underground firewalled was that any single accident couldn't bring down everything. The disadvantage was that she could never know what the big picture looked like. Even as one of Saba's top-tier strategists, she only knew what he asked her to know. And it was possible, likely even, that he chose to be ignorant of some operations himself. The commissary was wide enough to seat 50 at a time, but she tried to come at off hours when the three rotating shifts were in the middle of work or sleep cycles. The tables were bolted to the floor, but on the float no one used them anyway. The food dispensers were old, gray machines that decanted a nutritive slurry in 8 different flavors directly into recyclable bulbs. Even the worst rock hopper in the belt was more pleasant. Someone had painted bright flowers, daisies in yellow and pink and pastel blue, on the walls to make the place seem welcoming. Oddly, the effort halfway worked. Naomi ate the yellow, curry-flavored gruel with her feet hooked into footholds in the wall, but afterward there was coffee that was 1,000 times better. 3 environment technicians floated in a clump on the far side of the room, talking through a problem with the water purification system. The temptation to insert herself into the conversation was huge, but she held back. Hearing normal human conversation, but not being part of it, was like a starving woman smelling fresh food, but not able to put it on her tongue. She hadn't realized how badly she missed humans until she was among them again. And so when Emma pulled herself into the commissary, it was a relief to see her. In the days of Naomi's internal exile, she'd learned that Emma's last name had been Pankara before she'd taken Zamarodi as a contact name with 4 other people. She had siblings on Europa in Sol System and Saraswati, one of the 3 habitable planets in Tridevi System. She'd been in private security before she joined up with the transport union, and she had a hooker designed to function anywhere between 5 Gs and the float. She was also willing to talk to Naomi directly, which made her company more precious than gold. Now she pulled herself to a stop at the machines, took a bulb of something, and launched out to stop herself at Naomi's side and in her orientation. "All well?" Naomi asked. Emma shook a flat hand in a gesture that meant yes and no. "Captain Burnham won't talk to me, and Chuck won't stop." "I made things hard for you," Naomi said. "I made things hard for myself," Emma said, cracking the seal on her food bulb. "You're just when it blew up on me." "Fair," Naomi said. It was astounding how good it felt to speak to someone in person and without light delay, even when the conversation was banal. Maybe especially when it was. "Chuck seems like a decent person. He's underground?" Emma chuckled. "He's not cut out for it. He worries too much. The only reason he's not sucking down euphorics now is that he figures that no one will say anything to this political officer at the transfer station. Half of the people on the ship have something they'd rather not be looked at too close, and the other half have to work with them." "Seems tenuous." "Because it is," Emma said. "But we work with what we have. Besides, that's what the fight's all about, isn't it?" "How do you figure?" Naomi asked. Emma took a long, thick pull on the bulb, then shrugged as she swallowed. "The first ship I served on after I ditched Pinkwater, the XO had a thing for one of the mechanics. They were both babies, more hormones than blood. The company had a no-fraternization policy. But what can you do about it? The XO, she started being where the mechanic was, started using the ship's system to keep track of where people were, on shift and off. Mechanic didn't love that. Got to where they had a screaming fight in the middle of the medbay. XO started crying. Didn't come out of her cabin for 2 days. Good XO, otherwise. Mechanic knew his job, too, but both of them got fired. Rules, you know." "That's how you see the underground?" Naomi said through a real smile. "Making the union safe for romantic drama?" "Easy to make rules," Emma said. "Easy to make systems with the perfect logic and rigor. All you need to do is leave out the mercy, yeah? Then when you put people into it and they get chewed to nothing, it's the person's fault, not the rules. Everything we do that's worth shit we've done with people. Flawed, stupid, lying, rules-breaking people. Laconians making the same mistake as ever. Our rules are good, and they'd work perfectly if it were only a different species."
"You sound like someone I know," Naomi said.
"I'll die for that." Emma said. I'll die so that people can be fuck-ups and still find mercy. Not why you're here? Naomi considered the other woman. The anger in her jaw and the pain in her voice. She wondered whether Emma had been the XO. It probably didn't matter. We're all here for our own reasons, Naomi said. What they are isn't as important as the fact that we came.
True, Emma said.
Naomi laughed, and it was a hard, bitter sound. Anyway, I spent too much time already with people telling me they'd shoot me if I didn't do what they said. That tank's empty for this lifetime. May it never refill, Emma said. A flat-faced man in a command uniform pulled himself into the commissary, glanced at them, and did a fast double-take. The environmental techs looked from him to Naomi, then pushed off, shoving their spent bulbs in the recycler as they left. The officer went to the dispenser, pulled a drink of some sort, coffee, tea, mate, and left again without looking back at them. His disapproval made the air feel cooler. You've got what you need? Emma asked, as if the man hadn't been there at all. The question had more weight than the words deserved. I'm good, Naomi said. When we get to port, though, we'll get you out safe, Emma said. After that, I know, Naomi said. After that, she was still a criminal, still a fugitive, still a mouse looking for a safe hole. That would come. Saba may have something for me. I'll light you a candle. Meantime, if you need something, better me than Chuck, maybe, Emma said, then sucked the last of the paste out of the bulb, smacked her lips, and launched for the door. Naomi floated alone in the commissary for a few minutes more. She felt a little guilty taking a bulb of tea back to her cabin, but only a little. The Bikaji Kama was a massive ship, 3/4 of a kilometer long and wide enough to look squat in the schematics. It had been built decades earlier to ferry enough people and supplies to one of the outlying worlds that a self-sustaining colony could arrive all at once. Buildings and recyclers and soil and reactors and fuel. Everything that humanity needed to make a toehold in an unfriendly alien ecosphere, except a sense of fashion and guidelines on how to woo your mechanics. The halls were a drab green, with hand and footholds that hadn't been scrubbed in a few too many weeks. The ship conserved water jealously, using passive radiators to shed heat instead of evaporative feeds, and it left the air hotter than she liked. Her cabin was tiny, not just smaller than her storage container had been, but smaller than some supply closet she'd had on the Rosie. The crash couch was cheap, with gel that stank a little, and there wasn't enough room for her to stretch her arms in it. The design was called albupratir, back in the belt, because if your arm drifted off the edge in your sleep, a sudden deceleration could break it. Some previous tenant had illustrated the anti-spalling cloth with a complex and violent firefight between two sets of stick figures, one with colored-in circles for heads and the other pale and empty. Naomi strapped herself into the couch, pulled up the system and the false record Chuck had given her, and got back to work. The ironic thing was that with the access she had now, she could actually reach more information than with the passive feeds she'd relied on before. She tried to be careful about it, not abuse her access in a way that would raise any more red flags than were already flying. But she had requests out to the Union database mirror about political officers and changes to Laconian transfer point regulation. It was the sort of thing that anyone on a ship like the Kama might be, and probably was, looking into. It was only her perspective on the information coming back that made it different. Thinking that the political officer in Sol's system had meant something specifically about Sol was the mistake she'd made. That they'd all made. There was also one on Oberon, and that changed the scope. Now that she knew to look for the pattern, it was there. Freighters diverted to Medina on their transits, or held. environmental audits on ships that were running close to their theoretical maximum load. It still wasn't confirmation. Nothing so overt as that. But if there had been a massive wave of Laconian bureaucrats being quietly repositioned throughout the colony worlds, a new level of infrastructure being put in place without fanfare or warning, this was what it would look like. One political officer going to Earth was an opportunity. Two political officers being set in place in Seoul and Oberon were a threat. A new Laconian Mandarinate, covertly set to keep eyes on the transfer points, was an escalation. If Laconia continued the trend and put officers on the ships themselves, it was the end of the shell game. She flicked through the data, looking for places where she might have been wrong, where her interpretations could have been mistaken, or where another interpretation could have fit the same data. She was reaching for hope, the way a patient might by holding a doctor's hand and saying, "But it might not be terminal, right?" Emma accepted her connection almost as soon as she requested it. "I need to send a message," Naomi said. "Where to?" Emma asked over the gabble of other voices. "Upstairs," Naomi said. "Do you want me to say the name?" Emma was silent for a moment. Then, "Can you find your way to Ops?" "I'll meet you there," Naomi said, and dropped the call. She moved through the ship faster when her mind was on something else, as if her body, freed from thinking about her place in the rhythms of the ship, found them automatically. She composed the message as the decks passed by her, what she could say to make the situation clear to Saba, but obscure to anyone intercepting the type beam, either here or at the repeaters that bridged the interference through the gates. She heard Emma's voice before she reached the ops deck. Her tone was high and rough as a decking saw. Naomi pulled herself onto the deck and grabbed a handhold to stop. Emma was on the float by the comm station, her arms folded and her jaw jutting out. A man with a salt-and-pepper beard longer than his close-cropped hair looked away from her long enough to recognize Naomi, then back at Emma in disgust. His uniform identified him as Captain Burnham. The comms tech was between them, like a mouse at a catfight. "The answer was no before," Burnham said, then pointed toward Naomi with his chin. "Now that this one is on my deck, the answers go fuck yourself." "It's nothing," Emma said. "5-minute tight beam to Medina? No one would even blink at it. It's trivial."
"It's already too much."
He turned to look at Naomi.
"Don't say anything, you. I know who you are, and I know what you are, and I have extended my unrequested hospitality to you out of grandmotherly fucking kindness."
"You have as much to hide as she does," Emma said. "Everyone knows about the sealed cabins." The comms tech pulled himself down into the gel of his crash couch like he could disappear into it. Naomi considered the captain of the Bikaji Kama with all the calm and dignity she could manage. "I appreciate that my presence puts you and yours at greater risk. I wouldn't have chosen this if there were a better way, but there isn't. If things had gone the way I hoped, you'd never have known I was here. That's not the way it happened, though. And now I need 5 minutes with your tight beam." Burnham lifted his hands to her, palms out.
"Stop. Ma'am, I am not a partisan, but I know a lot of my crew are. I'm the kind of man that kens when to shut up and mind my own business. I'm not turning you over to the political officer, but don't mistake that for loyalty. I'm trying to get my ass out of a crack, and I'm getting more and more convinced that locking you in a cabin and welding the door shut might be an easier path than the one I've chosen."
"It's important," Naomi said.
"It's my ship, the answer is no."
His eyes were hard, but it was as much fear as anger. Naomi waited a moment, seeing what her gut said. "Push or back down." Emma sighed, and the captain's beard shifted as his jaw went tighter. "I understand," Naomi said. She met Emma's eyes for a fraction of a second, and then they moved to the bulkhead together. Emma fumed silently until they made the turn into the lift shaft. "Sorry about that," Emma said. "He's an asshole. I did stow away on his ship and put him at risk of a Laconian interrogation room, Naomi said. Expecting him to take orders from me along with it might be too much to ask. I'll find another way. I can help unbox some of those communication torpedoes, Emma said. Her tone made it an apology. I'd rather find another way to use the tight beam. Time may be important, but Emma, you have to be more careful. He's not going to fold, Emma said. I've shipped with that man long enough to tell when he's at his edge. There's a thing he does with his lips. I can clean him out playing poker, too. That's not what I mean, Naomi said. You said 5 minutes talking to Medina. They were going to know where the message was going anyway, Emma said. They had to. I didn't know Saba was on Medina Station, and I do now, Naomi said. Now if they catch me, it compromises him. Emma pressed her lips tight. Sorry, I assume that... Sorry. We'll tell him. I'm sure he has plans to shift locations if he needs to. Emma nodded, then muttered, fuck, under her breath. Even as she thought about other ways to get calm access, Naomi spared a moment to feel sympathy for her. Emma's hand terminal sounded at the same moment that hers did. Another chime sounded from down a corridor. A ship-wide alert. Or something bigger. Naomi thumbed the notification open. All Union ships, top priority. All traffic through all gates is suspended by order of Laconian Military Command. No ships permitted through any gate until further notice. All transits are on hold. All ships on approach are to evacuate the lane to Point 8AU immediately. Emma was moving through data fast, flipping from one interface to another, and so intent on her hand terminal that she didn't notice she was drifting. Naomi caught her elbow and pulled her to the wall. What happened? Naomi asked. Don't know, Emma said, shaking her head. Something big. Chapter 19. Elvie. The hard burn out of Tacoma system, without sedation, was a slice of hell. The crash couch felt close as a coffin around her. The breathable support fluid was thick in her throat. She tried to tell herself that it was like being in a dream where she could never drown, but every few minutes she felt an animal panic in the back of her head. Throughout most of human evolutionary history, the watery, inside-a-pipe-with-no-way-out view she had would have been the last thing someone saw before they died in pain. It was hard to convince her hind brain that this time was different. The monitor, weirdly, was crisper and easier to see than normal. Something about how the fluid did or didn't scatter light, or evidence that she needed to look into vision correction, she didn't know which. But she could track the ship's progress on its mad dash for the ring, and the data still streaming in from the probes. The fizz of miraculous protons kept coming into the system, and the spin of the Tacoma star and the magnetic fields it generated were pulling some of the new matter into a glowing accretion disk. It was almost beautiful, except for the part where it could collapse into a black hole and generate the gamma ray burst that killed them as fast as a neuron could fire. With the adjustable buoyancy in the tank, she felt the burn less as being pressed down and more as being squeezed in a massive and invisible fist. Red flight information data kept her aware of how tenuous her position was. Surviving a sustained 30G burn in a conventional crash couch would have been about as likely as living through a freefall drop from orbit onto a pile of knives. When they hit the midpoint of the flight, the Falcon kicked off its drive, flipped the ship, and started its deceleration in less than a minute. All Elvie experienced was a moment's vertigo and a bloom of black spots in her vision that cleared away again quickly. The animal panic rose in her again, and she fought to keep it back. "I'm not loving this experience," she sent to Faez. She hated that she couldn't say it or hear his voice. A moment later, a message came back. I know.
I can't decide if I'm panicked or bored. Very confusing. Been reading the safety guidelines. Turns out males are specifically discouraged from masturbating in the gel while under burn. Wonder what that test protocol looked like. The fluid made it hard to laugh. Her husband might not have been a good match for anyone but her, but for her, he was perfect. Hours later, they passed through the ring gate into what everyone still called the slow zone. The Falcon jounced as maneuvering thrusters took them off the mathematical line defined by the gate and the star. Under perfect circumstances, the couch would have cycled through three sets of progressively thinner fluid before it finally drained, but Elvie was done. She selected immediate release from the system menu, approved the override, and heard the deep chunk-chunk-chunk of the pump as it drew the fluid away and injected oxygen-rich air in its place. She might choke and cough and feel like she was getting over bronchitis for a few hours, but she genuinely didn't care. Admiral Segale hadn't either, because the first thing she heard when her crash couch popped its seals and slid open was his phlegmy voice, "For immediate evacuation. We have data that the High Council specifically mandated." Elvie pulled herself up. Her muscles ached like someone had beaten her with a hammer. She floated to the bridge. Stopping herself on a handhold felt like it was going to bend the joints in her hand the wrong way. Segale's couch was in its open configuration, but a film of fluid still clung to his hair and arm. The smell of it was too complex for her mind. Her brain kept reaching for comparisons and then abandoning them. Grape jelly, cinnamon, acetate, nutmeg, over and over. Behind her, Faez groaned. Segale looked over at them, scowling.
"You shouldn't be out of your couch, Major Okoye," he said.
And before she could respond, the comm channel did.
"Your request is noted," a familiar voice said. Elvie knew she should recognize it. The sustained high G's might have compromised her more than she'd thought.
"I'll do what I can." "Governor Song," Segale said. "The Falcon is on a scientific mission critical to the Empire. If we busted our asses to get here so we can die waiting in line..."
The penny dropped for Elvie. Jeun Song, governor of Medina Station. She'd heard of the woman often, though they had never met.
"Admiral Segale," the woman said. It was strange to be close enough to another ship that the light delay made interrupting impossible. "I had no warning about this. I had 64 ships in the zone, including Medina Station and the Typhoon. I've gotten it down to 28, even with you screaming through my gate and screwing up my queue. You can give my team a minute to run the numbers."
Segale's expression landed somewhere between annoyance and rage, but his voice was professional.
"Understood, Governor. Didn't mean to step on your toes."
He turned off his microphone with a gesture like a punch. "What's..." Elvie said, then braced herself and coughed up a thick wad of breathable fluid. Faez appeared at her side with a towel. She spat into it.
"What's going on?"
Segale put a volumetric display on the main monitor. The alien station hung exactly in the center of 1,373 gates, evenly distributed around the surface of a sphere that had nothing outside it. Icons marked the repurposed generation ship that was the oldest station in the space between worlds and the Magnetar-class Laconian warship that was the newest. Along with them, a scattering of ships in a space barely smaller than the Earth's sun. If the icons had been to scale, they'd have been less than motes of dust, fewer than 100 bubbles of air in a space the volume of 1,000,000 Earths.
"Governor Song is trying to evacuate the ring space per my recommendation," Segale said. "She is also trying to move Medina Station further out of harm's way in case a gamma burst does come through Tacoma Gate, but preparing the station is proving difficult, as it means stopping the spin drum and turning on the drives that haven't been used in several decades. In that context, I have asked for a priority transit to Laconia."
"And?" Faez asked.
"And her team is crunching the numbers,"
Segale said, biting each word off individually. He was scared. He was right to be. She was, too.
"Where's Jen?"
she asked. There was a sharp pain in her chest, more fluid coming loose.
"The others are sedated," Segale said. "There was no reason to keep them awake."
"She could have monitored the data coming in from Tacoma," Faez said.
"I mean, I can look at it, but Jen's the one that understands. I'd rather focus on keeping her alive so she can make sense of it later," Segale said.
"It's going to hit the station, isn't it?" Elvi said.
"The star, the gate, and that alien station that runs the ring space. They're all in a line."
"Yes," Segale said.
Faez raised a hand over his head like a kid in a classroom. Point of clarification? Do we really want to make a transit right before that happens? Because if I recall correctly, the whole reason that we have a Magnetar-class ship here at all is because hitting that little ball there with a massive energy burst makes an exponentially larger plume of gamma radiation pop out of all the gates.
"We have been able to use that effect to guard all the gates simultaneously, yes," Segale said. "The cannons on the cliffs strategy."
"And don't we want to be on this side of those cannons when they go off?" Faez was talking too fast. Elvi took his hand, squeezing his fingers, hoping it would calm him. "I'm just asking because the thing where we rush through to safety just in time to get cooked by the aftermath seems unpleasant."
"It's a calculated risk," Segale said. "We aren't certain that the station will survive the blast, or what will happen if it doesn't."
She watched new vistas of catastrophe unfold in her husband's eyes. The station might break. The slow zone might collapse. It had been unthinkable right up to the moment he thought it.
"Okay, yeah," Faez said. "That's a fair point."
Governor Song's voice came over the comm channel.
"Admiral Segale?"
"Yes,"
Segale said, then remembered he'd turned off the mic. He enabled it again.
"Yes, Governor, I'm here."
"We have slotted the Falcon for priority transit through Laconia Gate. I'm sending you the traffic control data now. Do not rush your transit. We're cutting it as close to the limit as we can here. I don't want anyone going Dutchman."
Segale's head came back a degree, as if the thought had surprised him. His voice when he spoke was clear.
"Understood. Thank you for this, Jeyun."
"If we live through this, you owe me a drink," the governor of Medina Station said.
"The ship ahead of you is the Plain of Jordan, through the Castilla Gate. Please monitor that and match to your plan. Godspeed, Mehmet."
Segale turned his attention to the controls, and a moment later the gravity warning sounded. Not that anyone else on the ship would hear it. Elvi had to fight the urge to shout the emergency evacuation command and let all the other ships figure out how to be safe about it.
"How long do we have?" Elvi asked, and then laughed. It sounded like she was asking how long they had to live, and since she kind of was, it seemed funny. Segale didn't join in.
"We're going to be at a quarter G for a while if you want to stretch your legs," he said. "Then you have to be back in the couch. Once we make the transit, I'm making a hard turn and burning perpendicular to the ring to get us away from it."
"In case of overspill," Faez said.
"From an abundance of caution," Segale said.
He passed the back of his hand over his eyes, and Elvi realized that for all his stoic reserve, he was weeping. The drive kicked on, and she drifted to the deck. Faez put a hand on her shoulder and drew her away.
"This is bad," he said softly.
"I know."
He nodded. "I just felt like I needed to say it out loud."
She took his hand and kissed it. It still smelled like breathable fluid.
"If this is all we get, well then shit." "With you on that one, sweetheart," he said, and folded his arms around her. "This whole thing really was a terrible idea, wasn't it?"
"Couldn't have seen it coming," she said.
"I mean, unless..."
Something moved in the back of her head. Something about the Magnetar-class ships
and the way the heart of the Tempest had annihilated the railguns on the alien station during Laconia's first incursion. The way it had killed Palace Station. The way the enemy had reacted differently.
"You're thinking something," Faya said. "I can hear the gears turning."
"I don't know what yet," she said. "But yeah, I am." A new voice came from the bridge, the comm channel still open on Sigali's controls.
"This is Plain of Jordan confirming transit in 2 minutes. We are go, no go in 10 seconds.
Another voice answered.
"Medina Control here, you are go for transit."
Sigali was muttering something under his breath. It might have been profanity, it might have been prayer. The volumetric display showed a single red dot in the vastness, moving toward the pinpoint white of a gate.
"We better get back in our cans," Faez said.
"Yes," Elvie said. But she didn't move. Not yet. It was designed, right? Tacoma System was designed to do this. Faez smoothed a hand across her head. The fluid was dry enough now to be tacky, but the touch felt good anyway.
"Elvie, you are the light of my heart, the woman I love and know better than I know anyone, and I can't get through the day without being dead wrong about what you're going to say or want. The protomolecule engineers were some kind of quantum-entangled high-energy physics hive-mind thing. I don't know what they were thinking."
"No," Elvie said, shuffling back toward her couch in the gentle quarter G. "It was designed. There was an intention."
"Does that help us?" he asked. "Because that would be great, but I don't know that I see how that helps us."
"This is the Plain of Jordan transferring our status now. We are on approach to..." The display stuttered and threw up an error readout. The lights went out and the gravity dropped away.
"Brace!" Sigali called out from the blackness.
Elvie reached out in the blackness, trying to find a wall and a handhold.
"What's happened?"
An emergency light stuttered on.
"Sensor arrays overloaded," Sigali said. His voice was shaking. "They're resetting now. I have to get us stopped until we can..."
He didn't finish the thought. The handhold buzzed gently with the vibration of maneuvering thrusters, and the Falcon swung up around her, lifting her feet off the deck. Faez helped her reorient as the gravity alert sounded again, and up and down returned. The volumetric display came back up with a warning at the edge that said, "No input, estimated positions only." Sigali gunned the drive for a few seconds, and the Falcon felt like an elevator lurching toward some upper floor. Then he killed it, and Elvie drifted up again. The three of them were silent for a long moment, while the backup sensor arrays lurched to life. The comms clicked once, rattled with strange, fluting static, and filled with the gabble of panicked human voices. Sigali killed the channel and opened a private one.
"Medina Station, this is Admiral Sigali of the Falcon. Please report status."
Elvie pulled herself to Trevon Station. She didn't know if it took the ship a fraction of a second longer than usual to recognize her and put her data on the monitor, or if it was just the adrenaline throwing her perceptions off. The main sensor arrays were dead, burned out in a fraction of a second. Backup systems slowly hauled themselves to life. Cameras and telescopes all around the Falcon unpacked themselves from hardened compartments and deployed. More of them were damaged than she'd expected, but not all. She opened a window and fed the data from the Falcon's skin to her screen, and in the darkness, there was light.
"This is Governor Song, Falcon," the woman's voice came, trembling like a violin. "We have sustained some damage to the ship and crew. We are still assessing."
The space between the rings was filled with whiteness. The station at the center, the alien control station that seemed to carry the rings with it like the center of a dandelion surrounded by seeds, was brighter than a sun. And some nebula-thin gas or dust cloud caught that light and shimmered. It was everywhere. It was beautiful. It was terrifying.
It's going to be all right, Governor,
Segale said in a tone that almost made it plausible. I need to know the status of the plane of Jordan. Did it make transit? Mehmet, I don't